This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. 2016 is just about history, and it was a doozy of a year. We're going to take the opportunity to look back at this past calendar year to try to get a sense of just how much the world has changed in the past 12 months. I have a panel of trumpet writers here ready to talk about the most significant, important, shocking, exciting events of the past year from our perspective. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
From our office in the UK, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, we have Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
As we usually do in our week in review, we're going to survey the whole globe. The world changed a lot in 2016. We hope to convey a sense of just how much as we have some lively discussion here about this overview of events. I want to start by giving each of our panelists the opportunity to make the case for what they think was the most important event of this past year. Now, I imagine there'd be a fair amount of agreement on our top two or three items, but to just make things a bit more interesting, we're relying on the fact that these men are focusing their attention on a particular region in the world. I think we can have a good discussion here by just letting each man pitch an item into the ring from your region, and we can discuss each of them in turn and just how huge each of these developments was, not just for that region, but really for the whole world. So start by just stating in a few words, just a few words, what you have at the top of your list. Brent, our Middle East man, most important event.
January 16, implementation day of the nuclear deal between Iran and world powers.
Okay, Richard, our Europe man, I've got a pretty good idea of your most important event.
Brexit, definitely one of our most forecast events of the year. Britain leaves votes to leave the European Union.
And Andrew, our man watching America, also not much of a nail biter here. Most important event.
Right. Well, obviously, as some of our longtime listeners have probably heard, on November 8th, there was a presidential election in America, with the election of Donald Trump as the next president of the United States, which in my case is going to be definitely the biggest event that happened in America this year.
Yeah. I think it's almost like we need like audience applause rising in the background for each of these events, like cheering on which of these is most important. Jeremiah, our man watching Asia, you've got some tough competition here, but there have been a lot of important events in Asia this year. The most important from your view?
I would say it was because we saw this year the beginning of U.S. allies defecting to China. And this is both a symptom and a driver of U.S. decline, and it just shows this rapid shift of global power from stability from the U.S. toward the East.
All right. So we're going to start by looking at each of these in turn. We'll start with Brent, the Iran nuclear deal. I'd like you to make your case. This was the most important event of 2016.
Certainly in the Middle East, this was without a doubt the most important event because it really did anoint Iran as the king of the South. This is what we've been looking for 20 years in the Middle East, for Iran to rise to dominance. And it was obvious to everybody. Commentators from around the world wrote about this on January 16th or around that date when this deal between America, basically, and the Iranians came to fruition. Charles Krauthammer said that January 16th marked an inflection point in the geopolitics of the Middle East. In a stroke, Iran shed almost four decades of rogue status and was declared a citizen of good standing of the international community, open to trade, investment, diplomacy, without giving up anything. And yeah. I think this, I mean, if we look at a number of factors, what happened after this deal was made, obviously this deal showed American weakness, declared American weakness and America's desire to remove itself from the Middle East to try and bolster its adversary of so many years, which could be part of the reason why American citizens, if they cared about foreign policy, then they would have seen this as a reason to vote in Donald Trump, to get somebody that would actually stick up for America's rights rather than conceding to the mullahs in Iran. But in the Middle East, what we've seen is this has given Iran a green light to further its actions of destabilizing the Middle East, gobbling up territory in the Middle East. If you think about the amount of cash that it was awarded in unfrozen assets that day, $100 billion, got to get bigger numbers here. You've got a couple of different things that happened. They got $1.7 billion in cash for hostages. We're going to call them that, hostages, American hostages that they were holding. That part of that cash arrived, well, some of that money arrived in pallets on planes, but then they also got access to unfrozen assets totaling $100 billion. Now, they probably haven't got all of that money as yet, but that is going into their coffers as we speak. Plus, sanctions were then, a lot of the sanctions were removed, so Iran got access to world markets once again. What did they do with that money? They invested 40%, well, they had an increase of 40% that this past year into their military. And what did they do with that money? Well, they have sponsored Shiite militias inside Iraq that have gobbled up territory for Iran, all pushing out the Islamic State, that enabled them to hire Afghani and Pakistani mercenaries to the tune of 45,000 of them to then go and fight inside Syria to support Assad. It also helped them start sponsoring even more the Houthis in Yemen. Five or six shipments were shipment loads of arms were picked up by the United States en route to Yemen from Iran. So with all this extra money, with the United States retreating from the region, Iran has taken that as its cue to start marching across the Middle East.
So we've seen changes in Yemen. We've seen changes in, you mentioned Afghanistan, Iraq. We've talked a lot about Syria. It's really changed the landscape for those countries. It's also provoked Saudi Arabia to take a more aggressive stance against Iran in a lot of ways. So there are definitely a lot of things happening in the region itself.
For sure. And it's all come underneath or in the wake of Iran getting more money, Iran realizing that the United States is not going to act in these arenas. They're not going to fight them. If we're talking about Iraq, they're not going to put boots on the ground to fight against the Islamic State. So Iran had to do that. They're not going to fight inside Syria, so that gave way to Iran to move in there as well.
I was just thinking about the just how much the world has changed over the last year. It seems like a year ago the big story was the Islamic State, and we're not hearing nearly as much about them anymore.
That's one of my other points here today, is that at the end of 2015 we had the Islamic State starting to fall. But if you just take Iraq as a case study, southern Iraq, the middle to southern Iraq, was dominated by the Islamic State all the way to 50 miles before Baghdad. Fallujah belonged to the Islamic State. Ramadi belonged to the Islamic State. But what we've had since that time is the Islamic State lose an extra 20% of their territory in Iraq and shrink back in Syria as well. Everybody was worried about the Islamic State at the start of this year. And what we've seen is the Islamic State shrink territory in the Middle East and start targeting soft targets throughout the Western world. But, I mean, the Islamic State's proven to be the boogeyman we thought it was, the excuse for foreign powers to intervene. If you're talking about Iran, they use that as an excuse to take over Iraq. If you're talking about Russia, they use that as their excuse to get involved in Syria to fight the Islamic State.
Jeremiah, maybe you could comment about this, just how much the implementation of the nuclear deal empowering Iran, driving the United States back. And that's kind of the way that you framed it, that it was. And Mr. Fleury, Gerald Fleury, the Trump editor-in-chief, called this the worst foreign policy blunder in American history. That was in our April 2016 edition. How much was that responsible for Russia saying, hey, there's an opening here, we can get in? We've seen, really, Russia step in as more of the top player in terms of Middle East power, outside power.
Yeah, they really have they've successfully challenged the U.S. as the sole global superpower. And that's not evident anywhere as clearly as it is in the Middle East. I mean, the fall of Aleppo, I hope to get into more detail about that in I think the second half. But that really was a gift-wrapped little, you know, package that Russia delivered there. And it was something that the U.S. failed to really do anything of substance with. We made, you know, noble attempts, I guess you could say, but it was all very half-hearted. And Russia actually changed the status quo.
And they seem to have just really relished the opportunity to demonstrate. We were talking even last week about the deal over Syria, how the United States wasn't even invited to the talks in Moscow between Iran, Turkey, and Russia over Syria. That's a huge development. How much has the oil that Iranian oil coming back into international markets changed things? Has that contributed to the decline in the price? How much is that really a factor?
It doesn't seem like it's contributed to the decline in the price, because the price seems to have jumped a little bit just because of OPEC coming out last month, I guess, to agreeing with the Russians to curtail its production at least. But Iran is obviously not going to sign on to that deal, and they can keep on pumping as much as they want. So I wouldn't say that's really affected things too much as yet, but Iranian oil output is increasing much more, just because it's been absent so long. It's from the international markets. It's taken a while for them to get going with their production.
Well, being that Iran has established itself so strongly in the Middle East as the predominant power, and it really has been the Middle East and especially Syria and the flood of refugees out of the Middle East into Europe this past year that has driven so much of the change in Europe. We'll go ahead and just transition over to Richard. You're talking about Brexit. There's obviously a lot of factors that went behind that, but it really was one dramatic event that occurred in that fateful day in June. Give us your case for why this was the most important event of 2016.
Well, what in so many ways was Herbert W. Armstrong's signature prophecy? It was this arrival of a 10-nation superpower in Europe. Now, that's a very clear prophecy that comes straight out of the book of Revelation, out of Daniel, and Mr. Armstrong forecasted that right from really the early days of his ministry, all the way back in the 30s even. And what's been one of the biggest building stumbling blocks holding that 10-nation superpower back? Mm-hmm. It's been Britain. And just to prove how dramatically that is the case, what did we see just days after the Brexit vote? The biggest push in decades for an EU military. We've seen more steps towards a combined European military since the Brexit vote just this year than we have in the entire history of the European community combined, really. Mm-hmm. It's still early days. They're small steps, but this has fallen apart way before now in the past. So that's kind of my pick case, really, for why this is my top pick. Firstly, we've got this clear, specific prophecy from Mr. Armstrong about Britain not being part of the European Union, not being part of this 10-nation superpower, a prophecy that can and already has acted to many people as a clear pointer, proving the Bible's accuracy in forecasting world events, proving that God was using Mr. Armstrong. And then at the same time, this single event is really paving the way for the European Union to unite and for this 10-nation superpower to arrive on the scene.
It is interesting. I was looking back through some of our stories earlier on in the year after the Paris attacks, after some of the terrorist attacks that had occurred earlier on. And those, we were talking about how that was really going to catalyze Europe to unite militarily and so on. But it seems like none of those events did it as effectively as British voters undertaking this referendum and saying, we don't want a part of this.
In a way, I mean, those attacks still provide the motivation for wanting a combined European military in many ways. And that decision in 2015 by France to invoke the common European defense policy has kind of been at the background of the common European defense clause has been in the background of so much of this discussion. So that event that you mentioned there, the terrorist attack, in some ways, that's kind of my top pick to be the most important piece of news to come out of 2017. Because you're right. I think it has. We've seen
spoiler alert
steps, but it hasn't. It hasn't quite come into action, I think, yet. The way that it will, in terms of just that real urgency in forming a European military. But I was umming and ahhing, and I did nearly put that as my top pick for the most important kind of story of 2016.
There was one writer who called 2016 the year of the political earthquake. And I think between Brexit and the American election, these were two huge events that really altered the landscape in these two countries, and the ramifications went far beyond America and Britain. And the ripple effects of the Brexit vote within Europe were definitely felt very strongly. There was one CNN reporter who said that there's never been a more humbling year for a reporter, because of all of the shattered predictions and the failed analyses that were undermined by voters going to the polls and saying, this is what we want. And it was just so radically different than what people were expecting. And it showed this divide between the elites and the populace in both of these countries that was really fascinating.
It does. In some ways, I've resisted this Brexit Donald Trump comparison, because just about everybody I know who voted Brexit despises Donald Trump and cannot at all understand him becoming president. But on the other hand, you're right. It's the same divide. It's the same the divide between the ordinary people and the ones writing the newspaper articles, occupying those government positions, occupying those kind of civil service positions, and showing just a divide so deep that just whole segments of the country don't talk to each other. You heard that from a lot of people after Brexit and after Donald Trump. How did Donald Trump win? How did Brexit get approved? I don't know a single person who voted for Brexit, or I don't know a single person who voted for Donald Trump. Mm. So it does point to deep divisions in both the countries.
All right. Well, we'll go ahead and shift over to Andrew here. Donald Trump's victory, most important event of 2016. Make your case.
Right. I'll actually continue on right on from some of Richard's comments, is that, like I said, it's Donald Trump, when he was elected, he kind of famously proclaimed himself Mr. Brexit. And there have been a lot of people have making this analogy between the Trump victory and Brexit. And like I said, it's not a perfect analogy, and that affects it. And like Richard said, a lot of the people who did vote for Brexit aren't necessarily Trump supporters. But it is also kind of like an American withdrawal from NATO and the world scene that we've been seeing for a number of years now under President Obama, that's almost intensifying now. Because Donald Trump, I mean, he's famously said many things during his campaign promises, but saying that if, like, the Baltic states were being threatened by Russia and they're a NATO ally, he said, well, I'd have to review whether they were paid up with their NATO dues before I'd make the decision whether or not America would defend them or not.
Yeah, it seems like both of these things are kind of a rejection of the move toward globalism and a demonstration of the faithlessness or the lack of faith in some of those vaunted international institutions that have gotten so much praise over previous years. This shows a lot of disenfranchisement with both of those. Richard?
Yeah, well, just picking up what Andrew said about NATO and withdrawing from NATO, we were talking about the European push for a military and where the motivation for that is coming from. And one of the other key motivations for that was, of course, Donald Trump. And this was being talked about very seriously in Europe well before he was elected, that if America might withdraw from NATO or not back NATO the same as it has before. You combine that with Mr. Obama's foreign policy that has really had Europe saying, we have to take care of our own neighborhood now. We need to take care of North Africa. We need to take care of Europe, of the Middle East on our own, because America's not going to help us. And it's those two things that every bit as big as, say, this rising threat of terrorism that have really pushed for European unity and this newfound seriousness on the European military front.
Which is a huge rupture for American foreign policy, because really since the 50s, this was kind of the European Union came out of the Marshall Plan to rebuild Europe. And it was really America in large part that was, they were concerned about the Soviet Union and the Cold War. So there were times in the 50s and 60s when America was funding like half the budget for European Union unification. So one thing is that in large part, we've built this European super state to help defend us against Russia and China. And now that it's almost a full-grown military superpower, we've decided that maybe there are some threats to us there. So we're just kind of like cutting the leash and letting them loose. And so that is a major change in American foreign policy that they haven't seen since World War II, which would be, I think, be really the main thrux of the issue of why I'm arguing for Donald Trump is the biggest news story of this year. In some ways, it's very similar to Brexit, and it's this with this withdrawal from the world scene that's pushing the rise of a new European superpower.
I was just thinking, again, to kind of go back to how much the world has changed over the past year. It seems like, say, this time last year, there was a much more confidence in some of those international institutions and some of the, say, the bastions of liberalism. We've talked a lot about, Richard, you wrote this article about how there's such so much disaffection with democracy, and people are taking these radical leaps into the unknown, or in a lot of cases, quite well known experiments in governance that are undemocratic. We weren't talking about that nearly as much a year ago, but it seems like with Brexit and with Donald Trump's victory, these are very strong examples of this trend that you put it together with, say, the rise in some of these more far-right parties and alternative parties throughout Europe, and you see this trend having really taken a massive leap forward into an uncertain future over this past year.
Right. I think it exposes a trend that in many ways has been there before but has never been as apparent as it is this year. I mean, we've seen those escalating votes for all of these fringe parties, and you just look at the accumulation of evidence that politicians are corrupt, that politicians don't know what they're doing. You go all the way back to things like the expense scandal that we had in the UK 5 years ago that just implicated huge numbers of politicians in fiddling their expenses and getting money out of the state. You had the Panama Papers that brought down Iceland's government, for example, this year. And you can just see how this has snowballed, this idea that politicians are just out there for themselves. I mean, that kind of perspective has always been around there, but it's just built and built. And then you had the financial crisis come along and people were saying, well, they're in it for themselves and they made a complete mess of the economy and we're the ones suffering. And then you see the euro crisis just leading to more stagnation in southern Europe. You can see how a lot of these things just kind of build off each other, leading to this perception that the elites don't know what they're doing and that they're corrupt anyway. And that all of that was just exposed Brexit vote and in things like the vote for Donald Trump. And then it has been in a whole bunch of other countries, like, for example, Austria, where you had this far-right candidate coming with this in a hair's breadth of being the party's the country's president.
Hmm. Yeah, you know, on top of that, I guess in addition to some of those established institutions, political institutions and so on, another aspect of, I think, the Donald Trump victory that's really quite extraordinary is the delegitimization of traditional media and just how single-handedly he kind of exposed how biased they were and gave voice to a lot of public discontent with the way that news was being reported. And we've seen some interesting ramifications from that as the media have been kind of lashing back after having been exposed for some of those biases. And it'll be interesting to see where that goes.
Right. I think I was reading something from Melanie Phillips a little while ago. We're talking about how Trump, he is definitely a flawed candidate. He can be quite crass and vulgar at times. They said normally, though, in America, those types of flaws would prevent someone from being elected. But people put up with it because they mistrust the media even more
right.
than they mistrust him, which is just this really condemning statement for the media. And it is, I guess, probably both in America and in Europe, just kind of showing this debate over fake news as they go back and forth now, where you get rise of like all sorts of alternative media sources, and then the mainstream media sources are trying to now push back against that and get even talking about like congressional action to label news sites as fake news so people won't listen to that, which, and then there's definitely serious concerns about free speech getting caught in the crossfire. But it'd yep. definitely be interesting to see how that plays out next year.
Oh, Richard.
Of course, the fake news story, I mean, you can't really talk about that without talking about Russia, because they've really driven this this story for the last 5 years or so, just with their kind of almost going back to Cold War tactics of disinformation, of setting up websites like Russia Today, like Sputnik, that are then kind of, and where you have things like Al Jazeera that try to do the same thing from a Sunni Muslim perspective, that contain some facts, contain some falsehoods, and are just ideologically driven with the national goals of Russia in mind. And just this, seeing the rise of Russia and then some of these other powers copying, that are willing to project power using every possible means, including things like news websites, TV channels. And so it's a story that really highlights one of the biggest stories of the decade, the rise of Russia as well.
Yeah, there's also an interesting, I guess Donald Trump has kind of epitomized the explosion of social media in a lot of ways, too. The fact that he's opened up this line of communication through Twitter with his followers. I don't know, he's probably got something like 50 million followers or something. And he tweets something and it makes news in a way that we've never seen anything like this from a politician.
Yeah, no, it is definitely unique. Every morning you've got this new barrage of tweets, and I've always some of them are quite entertaining, some of them are somewhat insightful, but it's just always interesting to see just how little hesitation he has to just call someone out. Where I think saw like some CEO oversaw some jobs overseas, and he's on Twitter's like talking about how it's like, oh, he's a bad CEO, and this is not a good deal for America. Or
right.
SNL runs a skit about him that's unflattering, and he's on there talking about how SNL's not funny anymore and losing viewers. But
okay, well, we'll leave that discussion there, and we will move on to Jeremiah. You talked about Asia fleeing America and moving toward China. I imagine everything that we've been talking about here kind of factors into this, the rise of this trend. But make your case. This was the most important thing of 2016.
Okay, yeah, this year we saw some key Asian nations, nations who have long depended on America for their security assurances and who have long been pillars of American foreign policy, particularly in Asia. We saw them defecting to China. Basically, these states see the sinking U.S. ship. They also see China's increasing power, its increasing determination to use that power, and they're making a calculated decision to realign themselves with China, or to at least lay some major groundwork to do that in the future. The Philippines is the first one. The Philippines has long been an anchor of U.S. foreign policy in the Pacific Rim, and now suddenly the Philippines wants the U.S. military out. They don't want to conduct military exercises with the U.S. anymore. They're buying weapons from China instead of America. They're refusing to acknowledge a victory that they won in an international court, basically a victory that the Philippines won against China, just as in order to please China, they say, well, we're going to forget about that victory that we won against you. We're happy to sort of kowtow to you on this. And the new president there, Mr. Rodrigo Duterte, he's really serious about drastically reducing the Philippines' reliance on America. And it just shows that he's also quite serious about tilting steeply to China. And then you've got the same thing happening in Malaysia, a longtime U.S. ally. Suddenly there's praise for China, a steep tilt toward China, for the first time buying major armaments deals, packages from China. And so Malaysia and the U.S. have long had a thriving relationship. just like with the Philippines, it's been a really crucial, you know, it's a smaller nation, but for America, it's about the geographic strategic location of some of these various nations trying to contain China's rise. But now the leaders of both of these nations are basically saying, we feel like based on what we see happening, we can no longer, you know, we can no longer stand up to China by siding with America. So we see this rapid shift, and we are just sort of making a decision that's really rapidly decreasing American power.
Well, you could see with at just how volatile this situation has been under President Obama, but it becomes even more so under Donald Trump in some ways. We've had this kind of back and forth just over the last few weeks about him making this connection with Taiwan and then backing off a week later and talking about Taiwan not so much as an ally, as a potential bargaining chip. You've had him making statements about the advantage of maybe Japan having nuclear weapons. And so you could see these Asian nations just trying to make sense of what the world is going to be looking like in the time ahead. And with China, as unsavory as it may be, perhaps there's just a little bit more stability and it's a little more predictable.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know what to expect from China. You know what their goals are. You know that you don't have to expect every 4 to 8 years for there to be a huge flip-flop, sort of a big U-turn in their foreign policy. That's what these states have seen now. The TPP, for example, a major trade pact that President Obama was spearheading, suddenly, you know, Trump is elected and says, we're not going to do that anymore. And so they've seen several issues like that where with a power like China, there's a trajectory that the leaders, for the most part, try to follow, despite if a new president comes into power. But in the U.S., it's quite the opposite. But I really do think that this story is big because it shows the fulfillment of two of the main prophecies that the trumpet has long been watching for. One is the decline of American power on the international stage, and the second is the rise of the power of those Asian nations. So for us to be witnessing both of these trends happening simultaneously, with longtime allies of America defecting to China, or at least laying the groundwork to do so, I just think it's a really major event. And it also, some analysts are asking about the domino effect of this. You know, which nations are next? What will we see happen in 2017?
All right. What do you think, gentlemen? We've got four huge events here that we've been talking about. Any idea of what we have to say the most important one? If we had to vote, yes, Richard.
You mentioned Twitter. I was just going to say, you know, you said this is the new age of Twitter. We should put this to a Twitter poll.
Oh, that's a great idea.
Stick the episode online and see.
There you
go. See whose region gets the most votes.
We'll do that. We'll do that for sure. Yeah, I tend to think that as far as just the ramifications, just how far this might go. I was thinking about Brexit, and you know, there are a lot of ramifications from that, but in some ways we're not going to see it. Well, we certainly haven't seen yet exactly how far this is going to go, or what the ramifications are going to be. I guess that would be true of all of these things. We've right. probably seen more than anything. We've seen Iran. We've seen
yeah,
quite a
definitely.
Few.
if I could just jump in, I mean, I think the biggest event where we have actual fruits of
right.
knowing what the outcome is rather than guessing what the outcome is going to be, we would have to say, I believe, that something that has already happened, and that is the nuclear deal of the run.
Because it happened in January last year.
Thank you very much. Prove my point.
You have the advantage of more time having elapsed.
I do. Yeah. I do. But we can talk about what Donald Trump is going to change. But those fruits, again, you know, we can look back next year and we can say, what was the biggest event? Well, obviously, it was Donald Trump coming into power. But if we talk about what gave rise to Donald Trump, it's a whole other host of issues. I remember doing a similar program back this time last year, and we're looking forward and projecting forward about what was going to be the big story. And we were just talking about how it was America's foreign policy, America's retreat under President Obama, that was motivating all these other prophetically significant events, if we're talking about the rise of Russia, or the rise of Russia, the rise of the kings of the East, what Jeremiah was talking about, Asian nations forsaking the American alliance, that's because of what President Obama was doing. If we're talking about, again, what happened with Iran, that was a policy enacted by the president. Mm-hmm. So I would say next year, Donald Trump might be the winner. But for this year, I'm going with Iran, for sure.
That's a pretty compelling case to make. All right. Well, we're going to take a short break before we continue our discussion of some other things that show just how much the world has changed in 2016. We'll be back in a moment.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Well, in the first segment, each of our panelists got to discuss the most important event from their region for 2016. Now we're going to talk about what else made 2016 such a momentous year. Maybe some things that didn't get as large of headlines, but that were still extremely significant. I want to start by just going back to the Middle East. We were talking about the ramifications of the Iran deal. And let's dig into a little bit more of what has happened there. One of the huge things really that happened was how much it was exposed that the United States really is no longer the preeminent power, outside power in that region. And Russia has really stepped into its place. Let me just toss it over to Jeremiah to discuss that for a bit.
Yeah, for Russia, the year really was a year of continuing to restore its status as a superpower, and specifically of challenging America's status as the sole global superpower, particularly in the Middle East. The Wall Street Journal recently wrote a powerful piece just about Russia's dizzying rise, especially since it's happening at the same time as America's global influence is rapidly shrinking. And the rise has been dramatic. I mean, we've seen Russian President Vladimir Putin basically preside over a massive project to restore Russia's lost power and influence. And this year saw him make some huge gains toward that end. I think it all culminated very powerfully earlier this month in the fall of the Syrian city of Aleppo. We discussed that a little in the first half, but basically the Russians, after a year of Russian bombing and just heavy focus on this city, they delivered this key region back to the control of the Syrian regime. And I think it just really revealed that Russia is now the Middle East's indispensable power broker.
Yeah, how far have we come in just a year? What's your view, Brent?
Well, I think that Russia, it's really interesting. I think I wrote a piece early on about what they were doing in Syria and how they were trying to show themselves as what Jeremiah was saying is this new power broker in the Middle East. But what they've accomplished that in a way by not really doing too much. Mm-hmm. They have been involved in Syria, which is a key part that the United States, or key place the United States, was trying to work a deal with, a peace deal. But you just can't. I don't want to get back to Iran, but you can't discount Iran and the taking of Aleppo for sure. It could not have been done without Iranian forces, because Russian forces are there doing what the Americans were doing, just bombing. And yes, that was a key strategy to help in the fight and taking Aleppo. But without the ground forces, I don't think that they would have been successful in taking back that city. But if we just talk about Russia and what they were trying to do there, they it's interesting because they announced back in, like, the biggest non-story of this past year, March 15th, was the Russians announcing that they were done in Syria.
Right.
And they were pulling out because they had reached a successful point. But so what I think we're seeing is the fact that they're still there is that they weren't able to achieve their objectives as quickly as they thought they were going to be able to. And that shows me that Russia, while they're rising, I think they look huge because America is so weak right now. But as far as their actual power credentials, I don't think they're there yet.
Well, that's a really interesting read on the situation. I'm just wondering, this is almost like a sort of a Russia's mission accomplished moment, like George Bush with Iraq some years back. Richard.
Yeah, well, while we're talking about what Russia hasn't accomplished this year, in some ways the biggest underreported story maybe is the continuing war in Ukraine. There have still been several hundred deaths there over the last year or so. And if you look at some of the experts' analysis of what Russia was doing when they went into Syria, they thought that a lot of it may be, well, to be able to apply pressure on Europe and to be able to come to a deal with Europe about Ukraine and some of these other areas where all of their interests overlap. And despite a lot of talk to the contrary, Europe's sanctions on Russia at the end of this year are still in place. They haven't managed to split Europe off the way from the United States on regarding that conflict and in other areas the way they wanted. Now, I think that's definitely something to continue to watch for in 2017. I think the biggest reason they haven't done that is Angela Merkel, and there are a lot of senior politicians within Germany that are much more open to a stronger relationship with Russia, a lot of business leaders especially, that are in favor of that. But they didn't quite make it this year, and they didn't quite bring about that alliance or that dente with Europe that I think they wanted.
You'd have to say, though, that Putin is in a stronger position today than he was a year ago. I mean, he made some pretty strong moves to secure his position to further Russia's interests over 2016.
Yeah, that's right. And he did succeed in Ukraine over the year just in keeping the conflict frozen. That, I think, is really the Russian goal there. He doesn't want to annex more of it at this point. As long as it's frozen, as long as it's not able to assimilate into the EU or NATO or even lose its role as sort of a buffer between Europe and NATO and Russia, then that's, in a way, I believe, mission accomplished for Ukraine. And then Mr. Putin also ended the year on quite a high note in terms of boosting Russian power. He put some major steps in place to increase Russia's already very robust nuclear forces. Last week, I think it was on the Trumpet Hour, we talked about the peace talks in Syria between Russia, Iran, and Turkey, a really vital deal that was hashed out there with the U.S. noticeably absent. And then he also bolstered Russia's presence in the Mediterranean just this past week, signing some deals to significantly expand the Russian naval base there in the Syrian city of Tartus, which I think shows that Russia's interest in the Middle East is not temporary. The expansion of this base shows that they want a permanent presence there.
Hmm. Yeah, I didn't want to sell Russia short with anything. But I said, I think in international relations class that I've been teaching over the last semester, one of the most interesting discussions that we've had or questions that we've had is who is more powerful, United States or Russia? Because when you look at it on paper, military spending, size of the economy, even just access, resources and population, not only does the United States beat Russia hands down, but China beats Russia, the European Union beats Russia on just those measurable factors. But you look at what what a lot of experts say, and especially Hans Morgenthau, whose textbook we use, they say things like, well, will, things like just the quality of the leadership and of the strategic thinking there are more important than those physical factors. And I think Russia this year and Russia this decade has really proven what you can do, even with a whole load of handicaps, when you have just a very strong, powerful leader supported by a relatively unified people, and that's augmented by state-controlled media, but a fairly unified block of people behind him.
That's a great point. Let's talk Turkey for a minute here. Another huge event this past year was what happened in Turkey to cement another strongman's hold over his own country, Erdogan in Turkey. Tell us about that, Brent.
Yeah, so this is something we spoke about at the beginning, or the middle of the year. July 15th is when there was an attempted coup to take over the government. Part of the military, part of the Air Force was involved in this to take over Erdogan from ruling. He's obviously been ruling for a number of years, coming inside the president role and then the prime minister role in similar ways that Putin has in the past, taking a page out of his book. And what we've seen is Turkey becoming a more of a power broker inside in the world because of its geography, because it really is a central player when you're talking about the Middle East connecting to Europe and to Russia. Turkey has its political capital, I guess, in the case of other nations, has increased this year. Erdogan has cemented his rule. He's used this coup as a means to get rid of anyone that would have, or the arch rival group inside Turkey that belonged to Fethullah Gulen and his movement. He's purged over 100,000 people from that anti-Erdogan movement. So what we're seeing is Erdogan is going to stay in power from now on. And he is also being approached by Russia in Syria to try and work out a deal. He's being approached by the European Union. Earlier this year, we saw to try and stop all the migrants coming up to flooding into Europe. So Erdogan has created quite a strong position for himself in his own country, but then also in the eyes of foreign leaders that need a partner to work with in that central a nation.
We also saw just how much he was able to leverage his advantage with respect to Europe because of the migrant crisis that they were willing to put up with and do deals with this fellow who really is kind of antithetical to everything that they're about.
True, though, in many ways, I think we saw those kind of fall apart over the last year or so. I mean, Turkey, it's been made abundantly clear they're not getting European Union membership. They're not getting the visa-free travel that they were promised in exchange for help with the migrant crisis. And perhaps the fact that we haven't seen Turkey and we haven't seen Erdogan just open up the floodgates for migrants coming into Europe, that could mean that his hand isn't quite as strong as it was made out and as it appeared earlier in the year. Or perhaps we're going to see 2017 Turkey say, well, okay, Europe, you've not given me what I promised. I was fairly restrained last year, but the migrant crisis is coming back way harder than before this year.
Yeah, there is certainly, it's interesting to look at the stats of the migrant crisis and how that stopped. If you look at right now, there's about 85 people, I guess, that are coming across into Europe, which isn't much. If you compare it to a month before the deal was struck between Europe and Turkey, there was 1,700. And then this deal comes into place where the EU is meant to pay Turkey about, I forget how many billion euros it was. But Turkey was able to stop that. I mean, they've got 2 million Syrian migrants still inside their borders, and yet there's only a trickle going over to Europe. It looks like Erdogan has only received about 500 million euros of that allotted amount. So Europe has paid something to Erdogan. But at the same time, as you say, there might be some more cards that Europe is holding over Erdogan to the point that he hasn't opened the floodgates like he could.
And then you've also, I think the other factor in that is the way that Europe just kind of threw Greece under the bus. And this is something I think we'll see come more to the fore over the next year, where really they just kind of sealed the border at Greece and told Greece, okay, migrants coming from Turkey are your problem now. We're not going to let them travel on to the rest of Europe. And it's made that route, I think, much less appealing for potential migrants. Now, you're right. I don't think that's the whole story at all. And I think Erdogan has played a role in that. But it will be interesting. I think they have paid the money, but they haven't given him the visa-free travel that at least Angela Merkel promised him. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that.
Well, we can't talk about the important events of 2016 without at least paying mention to the series of terrorist attacks that hit Europe, mostly as a result of that migrant crisis that we're talking about there. But we had a whole bunch of them capped off with this attack just a week or so ago in Berlin.
That's right. When we had this discussion last year, it was in the shadow of the Paris attacks back in November. And then if you just list, I'd forgotten about some of the incidents that kind of been so many, but there were the Brussels bombings, March 22nd. You had that Nice truck attack, probably the most dramatic of the year, on July 14th, where a terrorist just mowed down crowds celebrating Bastille Day in Nice in France. Then you had a teenage Afghan migrant goes on an axe rampage in Germany just a few days later. Iranian terrorist kills 9 in Germany, July 22nd. Syrian migrant tries to bomb a music festival, July 4th, and that's thwarted, but he still injures people outside. And then that terrorist attack in Germany on December 19th. So you just see a growing tempo of these attacks where it's not just, I mean, there were some big events there, but it's not just one big event. It's just a steady stream of attacks.
Right. And it's bookended. I was just thinking about the, well, I guess it was the New Year's Eve attacks. There were, what, hundreds of crimes that were committed by migrants in Cologne and in cities all over Europe. I mean, really, rapes and other violent crimes that went up into the hundreds. So you start with that and you end the year with Berlin and all of those incidents that you mentioned in between. And in some ways, the it seems like it's really building the fact that there hasn't been this overwhelming response. There's been a little bit here and there where the governments of the European nations have put policies into place to try to address this problem somewhat. But for the most part, you have just a whole lot of frustration rising among the European peoples.
That's right. There's a whole number of trends that this contributes. I mean, we are seeing Europe get more involved now into the Middle East and to North Africa as a direct result of these attacks. We've seen things like, we had Germany's white paper this year where they just made some dramatic changes to their military and signaled a much greater willingness to get involved overseas. And some of that is to do with these attacks. But then it ties into exactly what we were talking about before the break, with this divide with, say, the Donald Trump supporters and the Brexit supporters, where you're seeing in France, in Germany, the same kind of rejection of the media, because, of course, the media's first instinct after the Cologne attacks that you talked about was to not report them, to cover it up. And that led to a huge distrust of the German media within certain segments of Germany's popularity. And then with this latest attack in Berlin, Spiegel had an article just this week talking about how attacks usually bring a country together, but this is just widening the divide. And so you see just an increasing intenseness within Europe, just as we've seen in America and in Britain, where people are rejecting the mainstream media, they're rejecting the elites. They want, as we talked about, just a new set of people, but then are willing to experiment with whole new ways of government. And the terrorist crisis and the lack of response from so many mainstream politicians in Europe is feeding into that.
All right, good stuff. Let's just go straight into something of a lightning round here. If you could pitch anything else into the ring as to an important trend or event in 2016. Maybe we can just kind of go round robin, or if you just go ahead and jump in with something that you feel is important. We'll just start with Andrew.
Another big thing that they had happen in the American front here is the war on police, especially with the tensions rising with, like, the Black Lives Matter movement and then some of the government and media accusations against police racism has caused at least 20 ambush-style shootings of police officers in the United States this year. That's 150% higher than it was last year, when you only had 8 ambush-style shootings. To where being a police has always been a dangerous job, but this is just really starting to see the rise of this, like, ideologically driven, I'm going to ambush police officers because they're a problem for the nation.
Yeah. Let's go, Richard.
Well, slipped in most of the ones I wanted to mention. One I'll point to just quickly because it's happened, it's still on my mind. You had the Galileo project being finished. This is something that we've pointed out to, we've been writing on for decades, and there's something satisfying to see something that I think I first wrote on this in something like 2007, to see something that you've been pointing to the importance of for years finished. And it certainly shows, as we talked about, Europe's superpower ambitions, their desire to be up there in the big leagues with Russia, with America, and to be independent from America. And a lot of the discussion now about Galileo is being dovetailed with the same with the discussions about the military, with their desire to be a military power and a military power independent of America.
I think Jeremiah's got something.
Yeah, the government of North Korea, back in September, they conducted their fifth and by far their largest nuclear weapons test. This was illegal. It violated all kinds of specific UN laws there. And world leaders condemned the attack, but it's most significant because it is terrifying neighbors like Japan and South Korea. These nations are more and more terrified of this basket case nation that is becoming more powerful all the time, and it's prompting them to take lots of action to bolster their own military forces in ways that we've not seen in a while.
Andrew, you've got another one.
Yes, we also had the death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia earlier this year. Still hasn't been replaced, but as one of the last, like, constitutionally conservative justices in America, just showing the country is really just drifting away from that originalist, textualist rule of law interpretation of our government.
Brent, you got anything?
Yeah, well, mine's more of a trend that we're just observing it in across the world. And that is, as Richard was bringing out earlier, just the how democracy is being threatened. When we have entered like this age of strong personalities where people fear is driving people to not only just to ensure that they have a strong leader leading their country. You could talk about Erdogan, like you can name a country these days and you know the dictator that's in power or the strong man that's in power. Egypt's got Sisi, Erdogan's in power of Turkey. If you think Israel, you think Netanyahu, yes, that's a democracy, but he's been in there for a long, long, long time now, almost a decade. Why? Because Israelis are scared and they trust him, the personality. And what do we see in America? We're seeing men... The populace going after a man that they feel can bring the country back. Just this rise towards strongmen hasn't happened in Europe yet. They're a little bit behind the times.
All right, we'll give you the last word, Andrew.
Oh, right. And for our last one, we'll also talk about President Obama's visited Cuba this year. This first time a president actually has ever gone to Cuba since 1928 when Calvin Coolidge went, long, long before there was a communist revolution there. But this is just also showing just his outreach, like the Iran deal, to some of these dictatorial nations in an attempt to try to bring them back within relations with the United States.
All right. Well, that'll do it, gentlemen. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end here of Trumpet Hour. Send us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to all of our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Great to be here.
Thank you very much.
It's been great, fellas. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with a thought from Benjamin Franklin. What you seem to be really. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.